giving the unexpected. There are various ways to describe it. Turning the other cheek, going the extra mile, doing good to those who hate us, loving our enemies, pouring coals of fire on another's head. We may say it in different ways, but the action amounts to the same thing. By doing the unexpected, we accomplish at least two important objectives. First, we put an end to bitterness. And second, we prove the truth of the age-old axiom that love overwhelmingly conquers. Do you remember Solomon's statement? When a man's ways are pleasing to the Lord, he makes even his enemies to be at peace with him. Why are we so hesitant? What keeps us from doing the unexpected for the undeserving so that we might watch God accomplish the unbelievable? It flies in the face of our human nature, and we weren't raised like that. And furthermore, it's risky. Of course, that's where faith plays a major role. To believe the Lord against all odds and to obey Him, even if the action backfires, brings a smile to His face. Rabbi Michael Weiser did that. He took somebody's trash and recycled it into treasure. It happened in Lincoln, Nebraska. For more than 3 years, Larry Trapp, a self-proclaimed Nazi and Ku Klux Klansman, was spreading a message of hatred through mailings and ugly phone calls. He promoted white supremacy and anti-Semitism and other messages of prejudice from his apartment, which he declared was the state's KKK headquarters and himself the Grand Dragon. Weiser became one of Trapp's targets, receiving numerous pieces of hate mail, and from time his wife moved into Lincoln. The mail was followed by offensive phone calls, and at first the Weisers were so afraid after they locked their doors and worried themselves over their safety, and especially their teenager's safety. The harassment of racial slurs and obscene remarks intimidated the family. As Trapp, the 42-year-old, clinically blind, double amputee, spewed out his hate-ridden venom against them. And one day Michael Weiser decided that fear had gone on long enough, and he decided to do the unexpected. He left his message on Trapp's telephone answering machine. And Weiser made call after call, all of them unanswered, but speaking to Trapp about another side of life, a life free of hatred and racism. I would say things like, "Larry, there's a lot of love out there. You're not getting any of it. Don't you want some?" And I just hang up. And one day Weiser called and Trapp answered. And Weiser said, "I hear that you are disabled. Would you need a ride to the grocery?" Trapp was stunned. Disarmed by the kindness and courtesy, he started thinking. And later, the bitter man began to mellow and soften. And he called the Weisers one night, "I want to get out of what I'm doing, but I don't know how." Weiser and his wife drove over to Trapp's apartment that night and talked with him for hours. Before too long, they made a trade, and for their love and friendship, Trapp gave them his swastika ring, hate tracks, Ku Klux Klan robes and hoods. And that same day, Trapp gave up his recruiting job and trashed the rest of his propaganda. And eventually, the Weiser's home actually became a hospice for Mr. Trapp. He moved into one of their bedrooms, and as his health declined, and the couple cared for him until his death. The Weisers lived, Ephesians 4:32. Be kind to one another, tender-hearted, forgiving one another, just as God, through Christ, has forgiven you. Chuck Swindoll adds, attitudes of humility and gentleness and patience should characterize Christians. We are told to accept each other in love. So let's take inventory of our hearts. Are we living in the overflow of God's love? How well do I love the people in my life? Does the way I treat people reflect the way that God has treated me? Loving people isn't always easy. It isn't easy to love those who have been the source of heartache or abuse or rejection, loneliness. Some of you wonder how you could ever love the people who have caused you such pain. So what can you do? Conventional wisdom says that the lack of love implies a lack of effort, so we try harder and dig deeper and strain more. But could a lack of love imply something else? Could we be skipping a step, an essential step? Could it be that we're trying to give what we don't have? Are we forgetting to receive love first? Can God heal the ancient hurts in my heart? Max Lucado observes, Joseph asks these questions. You never outlive the memory of your 10 brothers giving you the heave-ho, but Joseph tried to bury it. And by the time he saw his brothers again, he'd been prime minister now for over a decade. He wore a chain of gold around his neck, and he bore the king's seal on his hand, and the blood-bedabbled coat of many colors that had been replaced by a royal robe of a king. The kid from Canaan had come a long way. Joseph could travel anywhere he wanted, yet he chose not to return to Canaan. Assemble an army and settle the score with his brothers. Well, he had the resources. Send for his father, or at least send a message. He'd had perhaps 8 years to set the record straight, and he knew where to find his family. But he chose not to contact them. He kept family secrets a secret. Untouched, untreated. He was content to leave his past in the past, but God was not. Restoration matters to God. The healing of the heart involves the healing of the past. So God shook things up. Genesis 41:57, all countries came to Joseph in Egypt to buy grain, because the famine was severe in all the lands. And in the long line of folks seeking to get an Egyptian handout, guess who the cat dragged in? 42:3. Joseph's 10 brothers went down to buy grain in Egypt. Joseph heard them before he saw them. He was fielding a question from a servant when he detected the Hebrew chatter, not just the language of his heart, but the dialect of his home. The prince motioned for the servant to stop speaking, and he turned and looked, and there they were. The brothers were balder, grayer, rough, tough-skinned. They were pale and gaunt with hunger. Sweaty robes clung to their shins, and road dust chalked their cheeks. And these Hebrews stuck out in a sophisticated Egypt like hillbillies in Times Square. And when their time came to ask Joseph for grain, they didn't even recognize him. His beard was shaved, his robe was royal, and the language he spoke was Egyptian, and black makeup extended from his eyes, and he wore a black wig that sat on his head like a helmet. It never occurred to them that they were standing before their baby brother. Their baby brother's response was, well, strange. He spoke to them gruffly, even harshly. He accused them of being spies, and when they protested their innocence and spoke about their family, he refused to hear. And he made rather odd demands on his brothers. Genesis 42, beginning at verse 15, "In this manner you shall be tested. By the life of Pharaoh you shall not leave this place unless your youngest brother comes here. Send one of you, and let him bring your brother, and you shall be kept in prison, that your words may be tested to see whether there is any truth in you or else. By the life of Pharaoh, surely you are spies." So he put them all together in prison for 3 days. By the end of the third day of their imprisonment, Joseph relented a little. He spoke with a snarl, continuing at verse 18, "Do this and live, for I fear God. If you're honest men, let one of your brothers be confined to your prison. But you go and carry grain for the famine in your houses, and bring your youngest brother to me so that your words will be verified and you shall not die." Joseph, he sort of gave them a taste of their own medicine. Take that, you rascal. Max further comments, "Isn't it good to know that Joseph was human? The guy was so good it hurt. I mean, he endured slavery, succeeded in a foreign land, mastered a new language, and resisted sexual seductions. He was the model prisoner and a great counselor to the king. Scratch him and he bled holy blood. And we expect him to see his brothers and declare, 'Father, forgive them, for they knew not what they did.' But he didn't. He didn't, because forgiving jerks is the hardest trick in the bag. We'll feed the poor and counsel the king, while we'll even memorize the book of Leviticus if God says to do it. But don't let the sun go down while you're still angry." Ephesians 4:26. "Let all bitterness and wrath and anger and clamor and evil be put away from you with all malice." Ephesians 4:31. "As Christ forgave you, so you must also do." Colossians 3:13. "Really, God?" Max Licato shares, "I have a friend who was 6 years old when her mother ran off with a salesman, leaving her to be raised by a good-hearted dad who knew nothing about dolls and dresses and dates. The father and daughter stumbled through life and made the best of it. Recently, the mom reappeared like a brother out of Canaan. She requested a coffee date with my friend and said, 'I'm sorry for abandoning you.' The mom wants to re-enter her daughter's world. My friend's first thought was, 'That's it? I'm supposed to forgive you? Seems too easy. Doesn't the mom need to experience a little of what she gave? A few years wondering if she'll ever see her daughter again. Some pain-filled nights. A bit of justice. How do we reconcile the pain of a daughter with God's command to forgive? Isn't some vengeance in order?" Of course it is. In fact, God cares about justice even more than we do. Paul admonished, never pay back evil for evil. Never avenge yourselves. Leave that to God. For he said he will repay those who deserve it. We fear the evildoer will go into the night unpunished, unknown, escape to Fiji and, you know, sip Mai Tais on the beach. Not to worry. Scripture says God will repay. Not that he might repay. He will repay. He will execute justice on behalf of truth and fairness. Case in point, well, prepare yourself for a surprising turnaround of the Joseph story. Joseph, after 3 days, he released all but one brother from jail, and they returned to Canaan to report to Jacob, their father, who was a weak shadow of an old man. The brothers told him how Simeon was kept in Egypt as assurance that they would return with Benjamin, the youngest brother. Jacob had nothing to say except in verse 42:36, "You have bereaved me. Joseph is no more. Simeon is no more. And you want to take Benjamin? All these things are against me." Max says, "Such a louse." Jacob played favorites. He refused to discipline. He had multiple wives. And upon hearing of the imprisonment of his son, had a pity party. What a prima donna. No wonder the family was all screwed up. But as we read further, a light breaks through the clouds, and Judah, who was once wanted to get rid of Joseph, stepped forward. Continuing at verse 8, "Send Benjamin with me, and we will arise and go that we may live and not die, both we and you, and also our little ones. I myself will be surety for him. From my hand you shall require him. If I do not bring him back to you and set him before you, then let me bear the blame forever." Is this the same Judah? The same man who said, "Let us sell him to the Ishmaelites"? The same brother who helped negotiate the slave trade? Well, yes and no. Judah, as it turns out, has had his own descent into the pit. And after Joseph's abduction, Judah went on to have 3 sons. He arranged for the eldest to marry a girl named Tamar, but the son died. And following the proper protocol of his day, Judah arranged for the second son to marry Tamar. The son didn't manage the situation well, and he soon died. Judah assumed Tamar was jinxed, and afraid his third son would meet the same fate, Judah put the matter on hold, leaving Tamar with no husband. Later, Judah's wife died, and Tamar heard that Judah was coming to town. And apparently she hadn't been able to get Judah to reply to her emails, so she got creative. She disguised herself as a prostitute and made him an offer, and Judah took the bait. He exchanged his necklace and walking stick for sex, unaware that he was sleeping with his daughter-in-law. Oh, how lust blinds a man. She conceived. And 3 months later, Tamar entered Judah's life as pregnant Tamar. Judah went high and mighty on her and demanded that she be burned. And that's when she gathered Judah's necklace and walking stick, and Judah realized that the child was his. He was caught in his own sin, disgraced in front of his own family. Things had come full cycle. Judah, who had deceived Jacob, was deceived. Judah, who had trapped Joseph, was himself trapped. Judah, who had helped humiliate Joseph, was humiliated. And God gave Judah his comeuppance. And Judah came to his senses. She has been more righteous than I, he confessed. Max questions, for years I wondered why Judah's exploits were included in the Joseph narrative. They interrupt everything. We get started in chapter 37 with the dreams and drama of Joseph when the narrator dedicates chapter 38 to the story of Judah, the brother, and Tamar, the fall escort. Two dead husbands, one clever widow, an odd, seemingly poorly placed story. But now I see how it fits. For anything good to happen to Jacob's family, someone in the clan had to grow up. If not the father, one of the brothers had to mature to the point where he took responsibility for his actions. God activated the change in Judah. He gave the guy a taste of his own medicine, and the medicine worked. Judah championed the family cause. He spoke sense into his father's head. He was willing to take responsibility for Benjamin's safety and bear the blame if it failed. And Judah got his wake-up call. And Joseph didn't have to lift a finger or swing a fist. Vengeance is God's. God will repay, whether ultimately on the day of judgment or intermediately in this life. The point of the story? God handles all Judas. He can discipline your abusive boss or soften your angry parent, or he can bring your ex to his knees or to her senses. Forgiveness doesn't diminish justice. It just entrusts it to God. He guarantees the right retribution. We give too much, too little. But the God of justice has the precise prescription. Unlike us, God never gives up on a person. Never. Long after we've moved on, God is still there, probing the conscience, stirring conviction, always orchestrating redemption. Fix your enemies, that's God's job. Forgive your enemies, that's where you and I come in. We are to forgive. Do not let the sun go down on your anger. Do not give the devil an opportunity. The word translated opportunity in the Greek mean is the word topos, the same term from which we get the English noun topography. It means territory or ground. Interesting. Anger gives ground to the devil. Bitterness invites him to come in and occupy a space in your heart, to rent a room. Believe me, he'll move in and stink up the place. Gossip and slander and temper. Anytime you see these, Satan has claimed a bunk. Evict him. Don't even give him the time of day. In the name of Jesus, tell him to pack his bags and hit the road. Begin the process of forgiveness. Keep no list of wrongs. Pray for your antagonists rather than plot against them. Hate the wrong without being and hating the wrongdoers. Turn your attention from what they did to you to what Jesus has done for you. Outrageous as it may seem, Jesus died for them too, and if he thinks they're worth forgiving, they are. Does that make forgiveness easy? No. Quick? Seldom. Painless? It wasn't for Joseph. The brothers returned to Egypt from Canaan, Benjamin in tow. Joseph invited them in for a dinner, and he asked about Jacob, and he spotted Benjamin and all but came undone. "God be gracious to you, my son," he blurted out before he hurried out and went out of the room to weep. He returned to eat and drink and to be merry with his brothers. And Joseph sat them according to birth order. He singled out Benjamin for special treatment. And every time the brothers got one helping, Benjamin got five. And they noticed this, but they said nothing. Joseph loaded their sacks with food and then hid his personal cup in Benjamin's sack. The brothers were barely down the road when Joseph's steward stopped the caravan and searched their sacks and found the cup. And the brothers tore their clothes, the ancient equivalent of pulling one's hair out. They soon found themselves back in front of Joseph, fearing for their lives. Joseph couldn't make up his mind. He welcomed them. He wept with them. He ate with them and then played a trick on them. He was at war with himself. The brothers had peeled the scab off one of the oldest and deepest wound, and he'd be hanged if he'd let them do it again. And on the other hand, they were his brothers, and he'd be hanged before he lost them again. Forgiveness vacillates like this. It has fits and starts, good days, bad, anger intermingled with love, irregular mercy. We make progress only to make a wrong turn. We step forward and fall back. But this is okay. For when it comes to forgiveness, we are all beginners. No one owns a secret formula. As long as you are trying to forgive, you are forgiving. It's when you no longer try that bitterness begins to settle in. Don't give up. Keep hold of hope. Stay the course. You'll spend less time in a spite house and more in a grace house. And as one who has walked the hallways of both, I can guarantee that you're going to love the space of grace. Selah.